folks. Welcome to the edition of Stranger in a Southern Land. I, of course, am your host, Jake Manning. Today on the program, I speak with former Major Leaguer Jeff Schaefer. I figure with baseball season right around the corner, who better to talk to than Jeff? And Jeff was a Major Leaguer for 5 seasons, but more importantly, he was in the minors for quite some time, just clawing and scratching his way up there. You know that story of that baseball player just waiting for that call? Well, Jeff got it. And the story of him getting his first start is very inspirational, heartwarming, and it's just really awesome to sit down with somebody who's been, you know, playing a sport for that long and still has a love for the game like that. And, you know, he rubbed shoulders with a lot of people. He was coached by Tony La Russa, Joe Maddon. He was teammates of Ken Griffey Jr. and Mark McGuire. And he encountered so many people that taught him so much. And instead of keeping that knowledge to himself, he's giving back to the baseball community. And he's doing it here locally at the Carolina Baseball Center. He's taking youths and letting them know that this is a game and honing their skills and honing people's skills to get ready to be playing in college and in the major leagues and the minor leagues and stuff like that. He's just doing fantastic things out there. It's an awesome facility. We sit down in the facility before they start taking batting practice, though. I think if we would have done this a little bit later in the day, we'd be ducking balls during this podcast. But we got it in, and it's a fantastic conversation. And I can't thank Jeff enough for sitting down and taking time out of his day and talking to me about baseball and the love of the game. But also, too, I must thank my producer, Don. I can't thank him enough because I'm recording this intro much later than I normally like to. But I had a power outage at my house, and I didn't have power Wednesday or Thursday night, which is typically when I record this intro. And then I had wrestling shows Friday and Saturday night. But because of Don's patience and his professionalism, I'm able to get this podcast out to you in a timely fashion. So I can't thank Don enough. For DSCT.TV Studios. He's the one that does all these podcasts. He's got a lot of other wonderful podcasts like Welcome to Connecticut, which is hosted by my friend Ken Tuccio. And I, you know, go check out all his stuff because Don's working very hard. And I can't thank him enough for his patience for me and dealing with me and all my crazy week that I've been dealing with because it's been nuts. It's very nuts. And we'll get into that, why it's kind of been nuts when we get into all the list of upcoming dates. But also before we get there, I want to let you all know to thank Shining Wizards Podcast Network. Fantastic guys. They put out this podcast on different audio platforms. So, you know, you don't have to have an iPhone just to watch the show or listen to the show. And it's because of Shining Wizards Network. And so make sure you check them out and all their podcasts at ShiningWizardsNetwork.com. Like I was just saying, March has just turned into the weirdest month for me ever. I thought I had a clear path of what March was going to look like, and I thought I was going to give you dates far in advance and very clear and concise, much like I did in February, but that has changed. March is completely different than what I envisioned it about 5 days ago. So things are in flux. I'm going to give you dates I think are pretty much for sure right now. So let's throw them at you right now and we'll go from there, okay? If you listen to this podcast in a timely fashion, I will be performing comedy at the Groovy Tuesdays comedy show in Anderson, South Carolina, at the Mellow Mushroom in Anderson, South Carolina. And it's a free show and it starts at 7 p.m. I've heard a lot of really good things about this. A lot of local publicity has been into these shows. So make sure you come out for Groovy Tuesday's comedy show at the Mellow Mushroom in Anderson, South Carolina at 7 p.m. Friday, March 4th, Newburgh, New York for Northeast Wrestling. It's been a while since I've been in Newburgh, so I'm very excited about there. Always a hot crowd, always a fantastic crowd. And I'm very excited about my match. Sounds like I'm wrestling Jerry the King Lawler. It's been a while since I've wrestled Jerry. And, you know, maybe I'll give him a pile driver this time. Who knows? We'll change it up a little bit. We'll see what happens. But also on the card is Rey Mysterio taking Caleb Conley, my good friend Caleb Conley. So this is going to be a big opportunity for him. So it's going to be a fantastic wrestling show. So make sure you're at Northeast Wrestling at Newburgh, New York, Friday, March 4th. Then the next day, I'm very excited about this one, Wrestle Pro in Rahway, New Jersey. From the guys that brought you Pro Wrestling Syndicate, now they're bringing WrestlePro to Rahway, New Jersey at the Rahway Rec Center, which is kind of a historic wrestling building. It was kind of in danger of not having a wrestling show because of Hurricane Sandy, but they've made the renovations. They've run a couple of shows there, and they're just building back steam back up for that building to be a hotbed again. So I'm very excited to be a part of WrestlePro Saturday, March 5th. Now, Sunday, March 13th, is the big Rise of a Champion PWX War Games. This is an exciting one. You know, it's going to be two rings, one big cage. This is going to be a huge event. And of course, we had to make a change. It's supposed to be a Cabarrus Arena, but now it's going to be in Charlotte, North Carolina. And all the changes about that are available at pwxpro.com, as well as tickets are available at pwxpro.com. That's a big one. War Games, it's historic here in Carolinas, so make sure you come out for that Sunday, March 13th. My birthday, in fact. So if nothing else, just show up to the show and tell me happy birthday. Wednesday, March 16th, Funny on the Fly will be returning to the Charlotte Comedy Zone. I've actually got to be doing that tonight, so I'm very excited to be doing that. And I'll be doing it again on Wednesday, March 16th at the Charlotte Comedy Zone here in Charlotte, North Carolina. Like I said, a lot of things are in flux. A lot of things are changing. A lot of locations are changing. Like I said, March is all over the place, and if you want to know all the changes and all the information of where I'm going to be at and what's going on, or if there's anything cool that you should check out, please follow me on social media. And it is very easy to do because I am available on Twitter at ManScoutManning and on Instagram at ManScoutManning. If you have a question about the podcast, or if you want to become a sponsor of this podcast, make sure you email me at jake@sslshow.com. Or if you're going to book me for an upcoming wrestling event, make sure you email me at manscoutmanning@yahoo.com. Anyways, without further ado, let's get into this wonderful conversation about baseball and the love of the game with Jeff Schaefer here on Stranger in a Southern Land. Folks, I'm sitting here with Major Leaguer Jeff Schaefer here in the Carolina Baseball Center. This is an amazing facility, Jeff. Thank you for having me here today.
I appreciate you taking the time to come out and see what we have going on.
Yeah, and it seems like this place is going to be extremely busy here in probably about 2 hours, I'm guessing. Is that going to be the case?
Well, yeah, once school gets out, we have a lot of the coaches in here will go off and coach at middle school teams in the area, and then probably around 5:30, 6 o'clock, it fills up until about 9:30 at night. It's just it's wall to wall with bats and balls and kids.
was that your childhood, basically, bats, balls, and kids?
That was pretty much everything that I had involved in my life, you know, one way or another. I mean, depending on whatever the sport it was, from ice hockey to football to basketball, you know, obviously growing up in a different time, we played three sports. So whatever the weather permitted us to play is what we did. So growing up in New York, primarily, until I was about 18 years old, you know, played ice hockey and, you know, football and football season and baseball and baseball season and basketball and basketball season.
Yeah, I was the exact same way. I grew up in a small town, so everybody was encouraged to do as many sports as possible so we could feel the team. So, but I wasn't that great at baseball.
it's not an easy sport.
It's not. It's definitely not. But when did you realize that it came easy to you?
You know what, I gotta say, I was fortunate as an athlete because I was one of those kids that whatever environment you put me in, you know, give me a little bit of time and I was going to be able to compete at it.
Yeah.
I just kind of migrated towards baseball because at that point it was probably the cheapest sport that my family could afford, you know, playing ice hockey and, you know, renting ice time and all the equipment and growing out of everything. And football is the same way. So, you know, you got a glove and a bat and you held on to it as long as you possibly can. And you kind of
you get a wall, you could throw it back and forth,
you can toss it in the air and hit it. Yeah, exactly.
So you can kind of play by yourself.
You can hone your own skills along the way with baseball. So, you know, I don't know that I had any aspirations of being anything great in the game. You know, I just enjoyed playing the game and it just took its own course. I, you know, I had successes through middle school, successes in high school. Really didn't think I was going to go off to play in college, and out of nowhere, I end up getting an offer to go to the University of Maryland, and primarily because my stepdad at the time had played there years before, and he picked up the phone and called the coach there and said, "Look, he's small. He's going to field. He's going to run. He's going to throw. You're going to knock the bat out of his hands the first year, but you know there's something here." So they took a flyer on me without ever even seeing me play a day, and I end up in a Division I ACC school. And by the time I was a junior, I was drafted by the Baltimore Orioles. So, you know.
There's a lot of points in between there. Like, how did that come to be? Like, obviously, you know, they're like, I just give a chance on this kid. You know, and obviously, you know, what was your motivation?
Well, you know, the trust factor, you know, it's interesting because what we do now here at CBC and with our teams, our DeMarini teams, is that we promote kids to the college level. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the colleges in the area, or the colleges that we've networked with, understand that we have a pretty good idea of what we're trying to do. There's six guys in this building at any given time that have major league experience. So we've seen some of the best talent in the world. We've played with some of the best talent in the world. One of the guys in our organization right now is Jack McDowell, who's who won the 93-19 American League Cy Young Award. So, you know, when we go ahead and we reach out to schools, they kind of listen to us. You know, obviously it's their responsibility. You know, the end falls on them, whether they win or lose. So they have to come see the kids. They're not just going to grab a kid and go, hey, Shafe said this kid can play, so let's go get him. You know, they have to do their due diligence and follow their, you know, their protocol. But for me, you know, it was a different era. And the head coach, obviously, my stepdad was an ACC catcher for him. And just, you know, took his word. You know, that doesn't happen anymore. So, you know, at that point, you know, I was lucky because I had no schools. I thought I was going to go into the Army or something like that. You know, I was just here. I was going to go to Suffolk Community College and see where life was going to take me, because I really wasn't overly ambitious, or I really didn't know what I wanted to do with the rest of my life outside of, you know, I enjoyed playing sports, and, you know, I was just going to figure it out day by day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny that you said all that. It sounds a lot like the story that I had, because I went to a Division I school for track and field. And I had no, and I was a shot putter. And like, as you can tell, I'm not built like a shot putter.
Yeah, what's going on here, man? Shot putting tennis balls?
Yeah, exactly. Well, it was 12 pounds in high school. It's at 16, and then it moves up to 16 as you get a little bit older. But same situation. Yeah. My dad was a decathlete for him, called the head, the coach there. And one of the assistant coach was the former head coach. Was a former head coach who was an assistant coach when my dad was there, and that's how I got in that way.
It's like a cousin of a cousin of a cousin type.
Yeah, and it's funny that you say that, and talk about, you know, this baseball center and stuff like that, that, you know, how far we progress. But I always feel like, you know, because I later found out that I would have been a better hammer thrower, but the thing is, I discovered that when I'm like 18, 19, when you got those Eastern Bloc countries, those kids are doing heel toes at six.
Yeah, they were doing steroids at six, too. Yeah.
Exactly. Well, their mother was doing steroids, and their father were doing steroids, and now they're these beasts that have just been produced. But like, I always think about those, like, man, if you want to be really good at something and achieve, like, you know, like a college career or a major league or minor league career, you have to be starting that at such a young age and be doing it properly.
Yeah. It's become sports specific, you know. It's to a degree, I think it's taken away from the athlete. You know, I mean, I think each sport gives you a different piece to the puzzle that in the end, whatever that sport you gravitate to makes you that better player. You know, I mean, there's the mental toughness and the discipline of football. There's the agility that's involved in basketball. You know, there's the anticipation and the quiet explosion of baseball. And if you're doing all those things, you know, you're creating this different athlete. Now, you know, we've taken all those other pieces from those sports and put them into a training facility and called it a baseball center. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so we have our strength and conditioning. We have our speed and agility. We have our, you know, our times where we push the kids onto a different side mentally. You know, are you tough enough? Are you not? You know, do you have the makeup to continue on? So on and so forth. So, yeah, it's getting to that point because, you know, colleges are expensive. It's mm-hmm. big business.
Yeah.
And you can't just flounder around. You know, you got to get on the track. You got to get involved in a certain organization like ours that promotes players to the next level. I mean, we spend a lot of time promoting the kids that play here to colleges. We have a good network. We have a reputation. And it draws players. And it obviously draws the attention of college recruiters and major league scouts. So, yeah, it's become sports specific. And it takes away because I don't get to see my kids. You know, my kids are baseball guys.
Yeah.
You know, they don't play basketball other than in the street. They don't, you know, I see them throwing the football around, but, you know, they haven't gone through the same processes that I have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's like I said, you have to be focused on it, like, right away. It's almost like, okay, at 8 years old, what sport would you like to?
We have them in here.
Yeah.
You know, we have them in here, and again, we're giving them a solid foundation. There's only so much you can teach a 7 and 8 year old kid before his attention span kind of disappears on you. So the objective is when you get kids in here like that, you give them the basics, you know, things that they're going to, you know, work on their fundamentals, but in turn, they got to have fun. You know, it's not a grind. And I think that's another piece that's really missed across the board is it's not become fun. It's become pressure to these kids because they got to get a college scholarship. They got to do this, you know, their expectations because the kid down the road is, you know, he's ranked here and they're not ranked here.
Absolutely.
It's almost to a sickness, you know, and it's unfortunate. So we try to avoid that in here.
Well, how do you do that? Because I'm curious. Well, look,
you know, we played this game for fun. I mean, I didn't grow up with, like I said earlier, the ambitions of being anything great in this game. You know, I was fortunate that it all worked out, and I ended up spending, you know, 5 years in the major leagues and 14 years total professionally. You know, my story is not the norm. You know, it isn't the norm. But I took the field every day as a player because I wanted to play the game. I wanted to compete. I loved it. You know, I never had the pressures of, man, you got to do this because you're going to get a scholarship. You're going to do this because you're going to get drafted. I didn't feel those pressures until I got to college. And all of a sudden I realized, hey, I am good enough. You know, I do have a different skill set than most that maybe I can be drafted. So, you know, the pressures are, okay, do I want to push myself to see if I can compete with the best of the best. So that was an internal thing. But some of these kids that come through here, these parents, you know, they're helicopter parents, and I, you know, some of them, they all mean well. Mm-hmm. You know, every parent wants the best for their kid, and they all mean well. It's just critical for us to make sure that when we have the kids away from that scenario, that they're understanding that it's a game. We're playing a game. Love the game. You know, because in turn, the odds of these kids getting to the higher levels, you as a track guy would know this as well. I mean, not every you ran the guys you ran against in high school and the guys you compete against in high school didn't go on to Division I schools. They probably just went off somewhere else. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it starts to whittle down. And the odds of people getting to these next levels, they minimize as we move along. 450,000 high school baseball players across the country. 55,000 college roster spots, then start to whittle it down to pro ball, to whatever. And now when you're looking at 55,000 college roster spots, you're looking at all from a freshman to a senior. So realistically, you're only bringing in a quarter of that because it's 11,000, right? You're bringing in 11,000 kids to go into as a freshman. So now that 454,000, you know, it dwindles down. So it's tough. So we want to make sure that these kids, you know, they're having fun on the field. They're coming off the field, we're high-fiving them. You know, mm-hmm. they know that when they're, you know, we're being paid to train them. So we have to take the time to, you know, to stop them sometimes and let them know what you're doing is wrong. This is the way to do it. Our philosophy is positive, constructive, positive. Mm-hmm. You know, stop, pat them on the back. Hey, you approached the ball the right way, but when you got there, you didn't do this. This is how you got to do. But I know, you know, we'll work on it. You'll be fine next time and move off. Mm-hmm. And not the pressures of, oh, my God. You know, if you don't make that play at 10 years old, you're never going to get a scholarship. You're never going
to
play in
the big
leagues.
Yeah, and you'll run into that kid that's already doing that to himself mentally, and then that just drags him down even further.
And that's unfortunate because as kids, we just want to play.
Yeah.
You know, we go out on the field, especially with the younger teams, and we may beat a team by 10 runs, or we may get smoked by 10 runs. And in between the games, you look over, and those kids are over on the swing set, jumping around, playing, chasing each other. They forgot about it, but the parents are like, oh, God, we got, you know, we're dying over here. You know, and now we're playing that team next. So it's crazy.
Yeah, absolutely. I think about that a lot with me growing up and stuff like that because I had a lot of pressure. Part of the reason I was so big in track was because my uncle's a world record holder in the shot put, so there's all this family obligation. I got to be as good as him.
I got a shot put story for you.
Oh, then give it to
okay,
me.
Okay, man. So in high school, we're playing in the Connie Mack World Series in Farmington, New Mexico, and we go out there and we have host families. Mm-hmm. So the big star on the team is a kid by the name of Neil Heaton. And Neil was, you know, he was going to be drafted by the Mets. Well, he ended up being drafted by the Mets. We know who he's going to be drafted by then. But he was going to be drafted. And he's a high school stud. And, you know, he's big, strong, good-looking guy. And so he gets off the plane. All these host families are there. And obviously Neil gets Miss Farmington, New Mexico's family to go stay with. You know,
obviously.
They got four runners. And he's going to have a good time. Mm-hmm. Well, myself and the other kid from Patrick we went to, we got the state shot put champion. And she was female. So
that's my
shot put story, man.
But yeah, it was always big in my family, but I always remember coaching wise was always important. Like my dad was kind of my coach because, you know, he learned from my uncle who was a master at it. And it's a sense of you have to be constructive where I would run into a coach. Like I recognized very early on that coaches that were very aggressive, I never gelled with at all. It was always the coaches that were the constructive. Okay, yeah, I like what you did, but you got to do like this.
Right.
You know, and it seems like a coach is like a big a big part of people's developments, because sometimes you have an athlete that's grinding on themselves for perfection, that sometimes you just need somebody to say, you did okay, but here's maybe what you want.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's, you know, we're psychologists when we start to coach, you know, because every kid that you get is different. Mm-hmm. And you got to find out that trigger, you know, what's going to make him get to the next level. And it's mental, you know, mm-hmm. It's just, how do you approach him? Does he need the pat on the back all the time? Does he need the hug? Does he need the kick in the ass? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, there's all different kids, and you can do that. Yeah, I mean, you can kick a kid in the ass, but you can do it if he has respect and he knows that you are there because you want the best for him. Mm-hmm. You know, not because you're kicking him in the ass because you're going to beat him down. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a poor approach in any environment, whether it's business or sports or anything else like that. You know, people like to be told, you know, something good.
Yeah.
And it picks them up a little bit, you know, but on other times, you got to step on them a little bit and let them know, you know, you're going to get eaten alive in this world if you don't, you know, if you don't step it up, you don't go about it this way. And, you know, I'm going to grind you. I have to do it with my kids. You know, I have two different animals at home. I have one that's, he's on the field and he's talented, but if a plane goes by, he wants to tell me how many seats are on it and how many engines and how fast it's going. Mm-hmm. And my other one's lasered in, and he's, you know, he's totally focused in the game and nothing around him matters. So it's interesting. So I have, even with my own kids and coaching them, you know, we have to deal with everybody differently.
Mm-hmm. Well, you feel like you're pretty good at that, figuring out those kids that need the kick in the ass, the kids that need the pat on the back?
I honestly feel at this point in doing both probably for about the same amount of time, and I mean that as playing the game. I'm 56 years old, getting ready to turn 56 years old. So I played the game until I was 35. Been really coaching for a little over 20 years now. I think that I'm a better coach than I was a player, you know, and I wish that I could invert it and go back now and play after I've done all this coaching, because I've learned a lot about myself on the mental side and approach, you know, reflecting, you know, like, oh, I'm watching this kid. Did I act that way? Did I handle myself that way? You know, there's different things I could have done as a player, probably to make myself a better player, but I never knew that until now. So the curse of
athletics. You get all the knowledge when the body falls apart.
Right. Be like, what's that, Benjamin Bratt? The kid goes back.
Yeah, the Benjamin Button, reverse everything. Button, yeah, exactly.
Then he goes back, and, you know, it'd be perfect for us. But, I do. I feel like I'm pretty good. I kind of gravitate to the kids that I think have it a little bit tougher than others, you know, to kind of make them feel better. You know, there's a lot of kids that come in.
Because they probably need that, you know.
They need it.
Yeah,
they need it. You know, again, it's those are the ones that, you know, they're either going to go one direction or another, and hopefully you can influence them to go down that right path.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, back to what you were saying before, you were in college and you started to realize, hey, you know, I can make a go with this, and you started to deal with those pressures and stuff like that. What was, like, the first inclination that, you know, you could take your baseball career and move it further past college?
Well, one, I knew I was a competitor, and I didn't want to lose, and I didn't want to sit on the bench. I didn't, you know, I was going to go compete for a job, compete to win. And when I got to Maryland, I was smaller. You know, I was probably 5'6", 145 pounds, which is far from the prototypical ACC player. You know, I just, my skill sets kind of, you know, overrode my size a little bit. And first time we took the field, And I started to take round balls and do things around guys that I have never been around before. You know, I grew up playing with everybody from the time I was 7 to the time I went to high school. Knew them all. I knew where I fit in that pack. I knew how much better I was. But really didn't see much outside of there until we went to the Connie Mack World Series. But, you know, I get there and I start to realize the environment that I'm in. You know, I had no idea what the ACC was or Division I baseball was. I mean, I really didn't. I was truly oblivious to the whole scenario of college baseball, because it wasn't in my future. You know, it wasn't something that I thought was going to happen for me.
You're just here.
I'm just here. I'm just here to play, man. So, you mean, I get to do
just
this?
Just try it out. See what happens.
Yeah, go out and have some fun and do what I want. I showed up with, like really long hair and I started to realize, hey, I did that better than this guy. I did that better than that guy. I did this better than this guy. And then also people start talking about draft. You know, oh, yeah, last year we had two guys go in the draft. Well, what do you mean two guys went in the draft? Oh, yeah, they got drafted by the Milwaukee Brewers and so on. I'm like, really? You know, so, you know, we're in that environment. So all of a sudden it started to click. And I started to say, okay, if I'm better than these guys, then I must be one of those guys that have the potential to get drafted. Let me see how far I can take this thing, you know, and without losing the joy of playing, you know.
Was that a conscious decision, though?
It was a conscious decision at that point, because I'd never really had that in my grasp, like to say, you know, you could have something Mm-hmm. And like I said earlier, I really didn't know what direction I was going in my life.
Yeah, to be that smart to be like, I don't want this to be like something I hate to do, even though I'm good at it. That's very intelligent.
Well, I appreciate he's calling me intelligent.
Well, no, but that's true. Like, I know lots of athletes. I mean, like between like, you know, my athletic career and even professional wrestling.
Right.
You know, I see guys that are like, they lose the fun of it. And all of a sudden it becomes like a job and then it just grinds on.
And that's why you stay in the game as a coach. That's why you continue on, because the game has been fun. It's given you so much joy. You know, I when I got done playing, I was 35 years old. Oakland was the last organization that I was with. And I left and went into business with a couple buddies, and it was completely different. I went into the textile industry and I wasn't competing, and you know, it was all gone. You know, and not so much the limelight of being, you know, sort of wherever you're playing, you know, you walk in a restaurant and somebody says, hey, is that so-and-so? You know, that stuff never was really important to me. But the ability to compete mm-hmm. on a daily basis and to be one of the best 800 in the world, that was pretty cool. And know that you're going to go compete against those guys every night. You know, it's not like you're in a semi-pro league or whatever. You're in the big leagues. You're against Hall of Famers. You're against the best that's ever played the game. So, you know, that passion and joy and all that stuff got sucked out of me when I was done playing. So I had to find the avenues, and I tried different businesses, things like that. We had some successes, and can't complain, but I just didn't have this.
You didn't have this.
I didn't have this. I didn't get to go out on the field. I didn't go, you know, go compete against another team and know at the end of the day there's a W or an L. Mm-hmm. You know, and all of a sudden start to develop kids and watch the successes of the kids. And then all of a sudden that first kid that you help get into college, or that first kid that signs a pro contract, and know that, okay, you know what, there's a lot of pieces that went into that kid, that happening for that kid, but it had a small part in it. And so we started to expand, and we started to build an academy, and we started to, you know, really focus on that stuff. So for me, I needed that. I needed to be back in it.
Yeah, and I always find it weird when, especially like in professional wrestling with me, I see a lot of guys that were pro wrestlers and that was their life for like 12 years, and all of a sudden they just stop and become insurance salesmen.
Yeah.
It's like whatever that was giving you is now gone in your life. Like, how, you can't just like take something completely out and then put a different piece in. It doesn't work that way.
No, you're taking type A personalities as athletes.
Yeah.
And you're going to go stick them in a corporate environment where there's too much structure, you know, where everything is, you know, you got to be. And I don't function that way. I mean, this is my corporate attire.
Oh, yeah. You know, well, this is about as dressed as I get.
You're looking good, then, man.
I was just wearing sweatpants at my job earlier.
You could have showed up here. I would have told you. You're overdressed right now.
Well, I'm wearing just tennis shoes. Nobody wear fancy shoes, but I toned it down a little bit.
Good for you. Good for you. But yeah, this is, you know, I'm comfortable in what I do. I'm comfortable in, you know, we work 7 days a week. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's 24 hours a day. We have our nonprofit organization. We have a showcase organization. We have this facility. So there's always something going on. The phone doesn't stop ringing. It's continuous. But it never feels like work. It has never one day felt like work. And it never felt like work when I was playing. Yeah, did I have to put the time in to make myself bigger, stronger, and faster? That was fun. I enjoyed it, you know? Mm-hmm. Results were there. And I think that's what motivates me, is that what we do, there's a lot of, it's result oriented, and results can come pretty quick. Mm-hmm. You can get a kid in the cage and you can tweak him a little bit, and all of a sudden he's hitting a few line drives. Good. Okay. Step one, you know, we got some results. It's not a process of, you know, I'm cultivating a sale mm-hmm. and it's going to take me 6 months to get there, you know, and I'm an insurance guy and I got to sell 1,000 policies before I can feed my family. I'm not built that way.
Yeah, most people aren't. Yeah. But, you know, you went on and you said you were part of baseball for 14 years as a player. Mm-hmm. You know, let's talk about how you went from the step of college to then the pros and being drafted, I believe, in 81.
Correct.
Was it, I believe,
Baltimore?
Mm-hmm. Baltimore?
Yeah.
Now, like what was the process of that? Like, I'm very naive or not knowledgeable on the process of, like, okay, you're drafted, and then what are the steps? Yeah. All I know is you go from college and then you're drafted, and then you eventually get there, but there's a lot of steps in between there.
Yeah, well, there's gaps in between there, more than there are steps. I mean, there's steps in preparing for the draft, mm-hmm. you know, getting yourself hopefully in the eyes of scouts, draft eligible or draft ready or draftable. Mm-hmm. So from high school, you're allowed to be drafted out of high school after your senior year. You have to sign by a certain date. If you don't, then you go into, you have to wait either a full year if you don't go to school, or you you go to school. And if you're into a 4-year college, you either have to be 21 years old or after your junior year before you're draft eligible. So going into Maryland, my junior year came up and I was ready, you know, but the gap was, for me, the gap was from birth to draft day, because I was not a draft eligible. I was draft eligible. I just wasn't a draftable kid out of high school. Nobody mm-hmm. came to see me play.
So it's like when you're good enough, then you can be eligible for the draft.
Pretty much, yeah. You know, and I got to meet all these, you know, these criteria as far as an athlete goes, as far as a baseball player goes. There's so much involved. You know, we have 5 tools that we grade on.
What are those 5 tools?
Well, it's speed, it's hit for power, field, and run. Mm-hmm. So those are the 5 tools of the game. And you know, you have to be draftable, probably have to do 4 of them well mm-hmm. To be considered. And obviously most draft kids are, you know, 4 or 5s. You know, there are some 3s in there. That's position guys. Pitchers are, you know, obviously velocity and command mm-hmm. and breaking ball stuff. They have a different criteria. So I just, you know, I was fortunate enough. I could run, I could throw, I could hit, and I could field. I didn't have any power. You know, mm-hmm. 5 years in the big leagues, I hit 2 home runs, and both the wind was blowing straight out.
and you were going.
Just got caught in a gale force wind. Yeah, I was helping.
You were helping as much as you could.
As much as I could. I thought I was going to be diving head first into second when I hit both of them. So it's, you know. But so I had 4 out of the 5 tools, and that put me in. It put me into the 11th round mm-hmm. of the draft with the Orioles. And you know, we went off from there. I just, unfortunately, when I got into the Orioles organization, I had a guy by the name of Cal Ripken in front of me. So that was, and who knew at that point, because Cal and I were the same age, except he got drafted out of high school in mm-hmm. 1978. I went to Maryland, so I had 3 more years. So he's already in AAA, and I'm in the lowest levels. But, you know, when he got to Baltimore, he wasn't going anywhere for over 2,000 games.
Yeah. So, yeah. So, he was kind of anchored there.
Yeah, so most guys were not going to get an opportunity to kind of peel through there. But, you know, being in that organization and the draft, you know, we go back to that. You know, that was it was an amazing thing. That's, you know, that's probably the most anxious that I've ever been in my life, because I did, you know, all of a sudden, you know, that process of when I got there as a freshman at Maryland to the point where I could be drafted, I did put in the time. I did put in the work. I did have that, you know, that goal now, which I didn't have goals, you know, coming out of high school. I was a goalless kid, yeah. You know. I was just, whatever life was going to take me, I was going to kind of go in that direction. So I worked towards it, and it was very obvious that it was going to happen. It's just where and how high in the draft, you know, because the scouts were coming out to the games, you know, and, you know, they were there to watch other players, but primarily I was a guy that they were really lasering in on, you know, because I was at Maryland, that, you know, that was my time, put yeah. it that way, it was my time. And I knew who that the draft, when it came around, somebody was, you know, I was getting letters, I was getting invited to these pre-draft tryouts, and it was going to happen. It was just when and where. So as the draft started to take place, and it didn't go the first 10 rounds, you know, for 2 days, I was like, ooh, okay, now where are we at here? Mm-hmm. And then it ends up, you know, I go in the 11th round on the third day, and I get the phone call, and it's, you know, my father says, you want to take this phone call? And I'm like, sure, you know. And they say, you know, congratulations, you've been drafted by the Baltimore Orioles. And it was just, whew, you know. So for that brief moment, you go, yeah, you know, I did it. And then all of a sudden you realize you got a whole nother journey in front of you and more goals to set, and probably harder work that was going to come, which it was, you know, in terms of motivating yourself. You know, I had to lift harder. I had to, you know, it became my profession.
Yeah.
At that point.
Now it's what you wake up, you get your coffee, and you go do this.
That's
now.
It. That's what every day is made for me at that point, is mm-hmm. to become a big league player. So everything that I do, you know, is in that direction.
Mm-hmm. Well, what was goal one? What was step one? Where did you go?
Step one, I ended up in Bluefield, West Virginia, which was the lowest level, which was rookie
God
ball.
Bless you.
We got there and we said the prettiest girl in Bluefield had 1 tooth.
God bless
yeah.
you.
Yeah. So, but it was, you know, it was amazing, because you come out of a major Division I program in the ACC conference, and you have a beautiful facility, and you have nice uniforms, and you know, everything is going on, and you go into the rookie league, and you have a dingy uniform, You know, mm-hmm. you're in like a, you know, the middle of nowhere, and it's, oh, yeah. you know, you're a professional, but it doesn't, you know, it's like, wow, this isn't really what I, you know, expected. And then obviously, you know, to get off to a good start, because you want to prove, you now got to prove yourself to a whole nother group of people, not just the guys, not just your peers on the field, but a whole front office. You know, what's going to separate me from everybody else and allow them to start moving me up the ladder from rookie ball to A ball to double A to triple A to the big leagues? You know, what do I have to do? So you evaluate. You know, you start to look around and you start to go, okay, here we go again, like the first day of Maryland. Let me see if I'm better than this guy. I'm better than him. Yeah, I do this different. I got a shot. Okay, let's not blow it. You know, let's get in here. Let's get the work done and let's get moving on. And it happened. It happened in so many different stages. There was ups and downs along the way and so many disappointments.
Well, how'd you deal with those disappointments?
Well, you know, interesting question, because I used to go back to those things when it was tough for me and reflect like, well, why am I playing this game? And then I remembered growing up, I played it because I love to play the game. I love to compete. I get to go on a field every night, put on a uniform, regardless of what level I'm at, and compete and play. And then in 2 weeks, I'm going to get a check. And then in another 2 weeks, I'm going to get a check. This isn't so bad, regardless of where I'm at. Let's see how long I can hang on and do this, and let's see how far I can take it. So the ups and downs were, you know, yeah, you're supposed to be disappointed. You're not supposed to be happy.
But just that thought of, like, I'm playing a game and I'm getting paid to do it was the thing that it was always the calming.
It was the competition.
Yeah.
I think it wasn't so much the money, you know.
Again, well, I didn't mean it to make it like the money.
No. But look, it was nice to get paid. It was nice to have that as your job. But the reality is, for me, it was just, it was what I wanted to do. I love playing the game. I loved going out at night. I loved diving balls. I loved getting dirty. I loved facing the guy throwing 90. You know, that stuff jazzed me every single night. And I was able to look forward to it every single night. And it goes back to the point when I said when the game was over and it was like, where is that? You know, I don't have that anymore in my life. So, you know, my first year in rookie ball, the interesting part about it, Ripken went to the big leagues. And I'm in the lowest level. I'm the only player ever to do this in the Orioles organization. I went from rookie ball to AAA. I jumped over everybody through the minor league system. To go up to the playoffs in the AAA level. So I'm thinking, man, I'm one level away from the big leagues. You know, 6 months ago, I'm in the University of Maryland. Now I'm in AAA, and I'm knocking on the door of the major leagues because Cal had gone to the big leagues, and I went up and took his spot. And little did I know that they only jumped me all the way over there because everybody else was in playoffs, and they didn't want to knock those guys up. So, hey, all the way down, get this guy, send him up, you know. So, but that was my mindset. Hey,
but you're in that spot, you know.
Sure, you know. They still chose me.
Yeah.
They could have picked anybody else, right?
Exactly.
And so I figured, okay, you know, I did pretty well. And, you know, next year, you know, I'll be in AAA, and I'll probably be in the big leagues in no time and, you know, thinking positive. Go to spring training, send me to A-ball. Okay, go to A-ball, you know, do my thing, and get called up to Double-A, which he was here in Charlotte. And then...
which you're like, of course, I was just in Triple-A. Of course, I'm moving Double-A.
I'll be moving up, you know.
Yeah, I'll be moving up.
I should be back. I'll be in Triple-A, and I'll probably be in the big leagues again at the end of the year.
Yeah.
You know, that's my mindset. Go through the rest of the season in Double-A, go to spring training next year, send me back to A-ball. Okay, end up in A ball, get called back up to Double A, have a good year. The next year I break camp, I go to Triple A, and then I'm tearing it up. I'm out hitting every single infielder that we have in the organization. I'm doing great. And they go out and they sign Alan Wiggins, that was released by the San Diego Padres. So now there's no roster spots at the Triple A level. Guess what, Schaefer, you're the young blood. We're going to send you down to Double A. You know, so body blow. But, you know, I carried my disappointment from the time I was told all the way to the plane ride, wherever I was going, all the way to the park until I put my uniform back on. And then it's over. You know, I mean, I can't control it. I got to go out here and do what I got to do to make sure that everybody knows that they made a mistake. I'm going to go back. And
you were that focused. So, like, I'll carry it here, but yeah. I get to this point, I got to put that aside.
Sure. I got to go out. I don't want to disappoint the other 8 guys around me.
You didn't have to carry it around like luggage.
I didn't walk in there and go, you know, I shouldn't be here. I'm better than that guy. You know what? I put the uniform on. That's my big league for today. You know, whatever uniform I had on, wherever I was at, that was my major leagues. And that's what I had to do. I had to go perform the best. You know, I had a philosophy when I took the field that on any given day, I could be the best player in the world. and especially at the big league level. You know, I'm playing with guys with Ken Griffey Jr., Randy Johnson, Omar Vizquel, Edgar Martinez, you know, great Jay Buhner, great players in the game. And they could have days where they went 1-for-4 and made an error, and I went 3-for-4 and drove in 3 runs. Mm-hmm. And I was the greatest player on the field that day. You know, now, consistently, obviously, Ken Griffey Jr. going into the Hall of Fame had a lot more of those days, but
that you got to hang your hat on something when you're getting body blows you after body blows.
You know what? You got to find something that motivates you every day. You know, you can't just go out there and go, hey, look, I'm a big leaguer. Look at me. This is great. I wasn't raised that way, and it just wasn't in my DNA. I wanted to go out and show everybody I belonged here every single day, and I was going to be something different. And, you know, it worked out. I mean, I wish I would have had more time, but I got time.
Yeah. Well, you got that time, and when you got that time, and you got the call up, like what that feel like?
That was an amazing day. That really was something special because I had gone through all these ups and downs, not only in the Orioles organization,
it
was almost 8.5 years, yeah. And it was interesting because I was with the Orioles for the 4.5 years, and I'm working out in the winter. And in my basement on Long Island, and I tweak my back. I was doing like a deadlift, and I lose my breath. I lose everything. I like go to my feet. I mean, ooh. I'm like I'm a mess. And I actually have to crawl through the basement, which is interesting because we lived on the Great South Bay, and we had bilge pumps in our basement because the water levels would rise, and I'd have to bilge out the water. So it was mud, and I dragged myself up the stairs, and I'm laying on the landing, and I'm calling to my family, hey, I'm hurt. My brother's playing the piano, nobody is, you know. I'm laying there, you know, and but I end up in the hospital for 7 days, and then
did you just pull something? Or?
Yeah, I went into spasms, and it kept coming on. They kept injecting me. They couldn't stop them. You know, I'd sit there, and I'd feel it coming, and just wrench my spine, and, you know, it was just... It was the worst pain I've ever been in my life. I've broken bones. I've been hit in the head. I've been everything else. This was excruciating because, one, I could feel it coming on. Mm. You know, I could feel the muscles starting to cramp up and spasm.
And then, of course, you got that thing going on in your mind, and you're starting
here to... Here it comes. Yeah. And your heart rate starts to go and everything like that. So
And that becomes like a panic attack on top of everything.
And it just accentuates anything that was going on.
Because you're now stiff.
Yeah, here I am, man. I'm locking up, and I'm in tears, and my parents are like, what's wrong? You know, so... But then, you know, without social media and without, you know, all this MLB network and all this other stuff, any type of trade or anything like that, you usually heard it by phone. Somebody had to call you and tell you you were traded or sold or whatever. Or you read it in the sporting news. That was the Bible.
Yeah.
And my father brought the paper in to me, and he said, you need to read this. And so I read it, and it ends up you know, you've been sold to the California Angels for $100. So I go over to California.
Well, $100 is probably a lot back then.
you know, a raggedy bag of balls or something too. I don't know, but you know, so I end up going. I end up going to Midland, Texas, which was Double A. So now I went from Triple A back to Double A. But the good part about that is I was primarily a second baseman when I was in the Orioles organization. Played no short, and they made me a shortstop. And so I had a good year with them. They didn't protect me on the 40-man roster, so I was eligible to be what they called a Rule 5 draft. And the Dodgers drafted me first round, first pick, Rule 5, except in that draft, we don't get money. The teams exchange money. Mm-hmm. But I go to L.A. To their organization, and I play short of there every day, and I have another good year, have an all-star year in Double A. And go up to Albuquerque. We win the championship. So within those 2 years, I played for Joe Madden in Midland, Texas, the Cubs manager now. I played for Terry Collins, the Mets manager now. And then from Albuquerque, then I became a free agent. And I signed with the White Sox and spent the full year in AAA with them. Did well. Didn't get called up in September at the end of that year. Decided that it's probably time for me to hang them up. And basically told the guys, you know, I won't be back. And I get a phone call in December saying, you got a chance to make this big league team. If you come back as a utility man, you know, you're interested. And I was like, you know, and I didn't stop working out, you know, I just, because it was in my, you know, it's a routine. And then, of course, it's hard.
It's, you know, as an athlete, we go through two deaths. You know, the end of our career and then the end of our life. And sometimes it's very hard to let go of the first, you know.
Yeah.
Or the second one, you don't have a whole lot of choice.
No. The second one, you're right, we don't.
Yeah.
So, I decided that, I would go back and give it a go. And Went as a non-roster, wasn't a 40-man roster invite, and they went ahead and they made a decision that at the end of spring that, you know, they were going to get rid of Donnie Hill, who had been their backup the year before, and that I was going to be the utility guy. So they called me down the line in spring training, and Jeff Torborg was our manager, and Jeff said, you're going north with the team. And those words right there are just, they're phenomenal, especially if somebody's never been to the big leagues. And to make a team out of spring training as a non-roster invite, you know, I wasn't even expected. I was just kind of, come on in, fill in, you know. And, you know, if it works out, maybe you got a shot. If it doesn't, you don't. And I make the team, and, you know, I go to Chicago. And, you know, we end up, we go to Chicago first. We pack everything up. We get regrouped, and then we head to Oakland for our first series. And It was an amazing feeling to put on a big league uniform and walk out onto a big league field.
It always seems like it's when you absolutely give up is when, like, you get everything you wanted, it seems like. It doesn't always seem like the case. Like, it's like, all right, I'm done, and then that's when you
I've seen some guys have charm lives and walk right through everything, like Jeter and stuff like that, but those are rare. You know, I guess it's you know, it's to the point where that love lost thing, you know?
Yeah, it's the first time, like Morgan Freeman, The Shawshank Redemption. There it's like, go. I don't care anymore. Yeah, and then that's when you get paroled.
I'm done. You know, and that, you know what? That's the attitude sometimes with the kids, and you're talking about going back to the pressures of them. You know, just go play the game. Act like it's not, you know, don't worry about what that person's saying. Don't worry about this. It's tough when it's your parent, you know, behind the chain link and they're screaming at you. But, you know, if you can get to that point, you're right. You know, there's times in our lives that we just go, whatever. You know, it's just, we'll take the hit and let's move on.
Yeah. And then sometimes that's when all the success comes. You see, right. You just finally relax enough to just do it sometimes. Right. But, you know, you spend a considerable amount of time in the big leagues, utility man primarily and stuff like that. And you got to play with a lot of people. Like, I was just going through your website. You were listing some people, like you were talking about Mark McGwire, Tommy La Russa.
Tony La Russa was a manager. Yes. Yep. So,
and just, you know, you talk about Joe Maddon there and stuff like that. But, like, you brushed shoulders and were playing and were teammates of some very successful people and stuff like that, like Hall of Famers.
Yes.
What do you think is the difference between them and other successful baseball players? Like, what makes them more than just a two-time All-Star or just a guy that was pretty good? Like, what makes them that level of extraordinary?
There's a lot of tangible, and then there's a lot of intangible that are involved in greatness, I think. You know, the tangible, obviously, you know, God gave them a gift better than everybody else. They could throw harder, run faster, hit further, or they're the whole package. To watch Griffey at 19, 20, 21, 22, 23 years old, unbelievable. Just, and it's so graceful, you know, just almost effortless in everything he did. And it was just kind of like unfair, you know. It's just like, but then, to have the mental toughness to endure a 162-game schedule, to travel, you know, the ability to focus, you know, every single night, the abilities to do things that are not expected. Also, you know, he ran up a wall to catch a ball, you know. I mean, there's so many different things that go into it. You know, I think the intangible probably outweighs the tangible to a degree, because when you get to that level, the talent-wise, the physical talent, you know, it's pretty much, it's minute difference, you know, between what guys can do. It's just how they rise in those moments of pressure. You know, the great players do great things in great moments, you know, and you see it on the highlights all day long, you know. How does Cal Ripken hit in his last All-Star game, hit a home run? How does Griffey in his last at-bat do X, Y, and Z? Jeter get a hit? You know, the gods, you know, he was that wasn't supposed to be his last at-bat. His last at-bat, he grounded out. And then all of a sudden the game changes, you know, within two innings, and he comes up and Derek Jeter, and he gets a base hit to drive in the game-winning run. And, you know, forever he's going to be shown on film jumping up in the air. And so, you know, those intangibles, it's those guys that know how to rise consistently in those moments. We've all had great moments and done great things, you know, in the game. It's just how often have you done it? You know, are there more successes and failures, and are the moments bigger that you've done it in than just your average, you know, you're in the middle of the season and we're going to win a game and you drive in to run. You know, you're doing it on the World Series stage. Why guys like David Ortiz is going to go to the Hall of Fame as a designated hitter, because what he does in postseason, off the charts, you know. I mean, just what Derek Derek Jeter did in the postseason, off the charts. You know, just continues. So those are the intangibles that I think take the great athlete, you know, the elite athlete, the top 800 in the world, and separate them out into 2, 3, 4, 5, 10, 20 guys mm-hmm. that are going to eventually move on to the Hall of Fame.
But also, too, not just the players, but also the managers and stuff. Like you work with great managers and stuff. Yeah. Like that. Now you're involved in coaching young kids and helping them develop. Like, what lessons did you take from some of those great managers?
You know, not just managers along the way, but there's something that you've taken away from every coach in your life. You know, you were talking about your uncle and all these other mm-hmm. guys, and even the guys that, you know, you didn't really respond to. That didn't get the most. There's something there, you know. You needed to be around that guy to find out that this guy was the guy that I could, you know, that I could really learn from. And you know, this wasn't the best for me. But there's always something. So coaches along the way, you take something from every single one of them, mm-hmm. whether it's, you know, a plus or a minus. Maybe it's a motivator. Maybe it's something that, you know, hey, I don't like you. Okay, well, you don't like me. I'm going to show you why. You know, I'm going to show you. Now I'm going to come back and beat you because you don't like me. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I was really fortunate to, you know, I played for Joe Maddon. You know, I played for Terry Collins. I played for Charlie Manuel. I played for Tony La Russa. I played for one of the best baseball guys I know and I love to this day. And there's other reasons other than whether he was a baseball guy. And that was Jeff Torborg. And nobody ever talks about Jeff Torborg as a manager. But he was probably the best human being that I met in that journey in terms of, you know, being in a position of authority and writing a lineup and, you know, managing major league players. He was different.
How was he different? What do you think it was?
Well, you know, I can just, you know, on a personal level, he communicated well. He was very articulate. He had a demeanor that really didn't waver. It wasn't a high, it wasn't a low, you know. You know, he respected you whether you were 0 for 40 or 4 for, you know, 10 for 10, you know, he was that guy. I was in, we were in spring training, and he had told me a story before I made the big league team, because he was the manager that called me down the line and said, Shafe, you're going north. Mm-hmm. So obviously a special time in my life, you know, yeah. Coming from a special man telling me that. But he said, he was telling me a story when he was with the Dodgers as a rookie. Walter Alston was his manager, and Walter Alston had not started him. They broke the season, and they went to the West Coast, and they went back to somewhere, and then they went somewhere else, and it was almost like 2.5-3 weeks before he got a start. And he was with the Los Angeles Dodgers. Well, they're going east to New York to play against the Mets, and Jeff grew up in New Jersey. And Walter Alston saved his first start for the Mets series so all his family could be there and celebrate that day with him. And it was his first big league start. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I mean, I'm, you know, piss and vinegar. I'm like, hey, great story, man. You know, really, you know, really cool story, Jeff. What does it mean? Didn't mean anything to me at the time. It was just a story. Little do I know, he's teeing me up. So we break camp, you know, and we go to Oakland. We come back to Chicago. We do whatever. And then we end up going to Yankee Stadium, like 2 weeks. And I don't start a game. I've gotten in games, a pinch run. I've you know, I've gotten an at bat here and there, but I've never started a game. Mm-hmm. So I'm starting to become concerned. Like, you know, what's going on here, man? Do these guys not want me? Do they not like me? Whatever. We find out. We go into New York on a Friday night. A brawl breaks out. I'm in the middle of the brawl. I get thrown out of the game. You know, I went in for a replacement. Didn't start that game. We're in Yankee Stadium, and I grew up a Yankee fan, diehard Yankee fan. And Saturday comes, don't start. And I'm like, oh, man, this isn't good. Sunday comes, packed house in Yankee Stadium, beautiful day. I start. And it clicks. I have 170-plus people, 2 busloads come in from my hometown on Patchogue. And, you know, my family, my friends are standing on the you know, the third base rails. I'm taking infield and everything. And I'm in the starting lineup in Yankee Stadium. So he did that for me, you know. He didn't have to do that, and he made that debut in the major leagues more special than just a debut, you know. And I debuted as far as a pinch hitter and a pinch runner; those are great.
Yeah.
But when you start your first game, it was incredible. And this man had enough heart about people and the game to save a moment like that for me. Because you know what? He knew the odds of me being in the big leagues were slim. I wasn't a high draft pick. I was small. I had a scrap. I had a kick. I had ups, downs. I had everything that was going on there. And he knew my history. And he took that upon himself to go ahead and make that day. I could have left the game that day. And it would have been the most unbelievable journey of any life. Fortunately, I got to play longer. But, you know, I'll never, ever, ever forget that man or, you know, what he did. So talking about the managers and going back, yeah, great technicians, great game managers, great, you know, what preparation guys that, you know, but nobody had a better heart than this guy. Nobody showed more for the player or cared more for the player than this man. And that's Jeff Torborg. And to this day, he's you know, he's in my mind, he's greatness.
Yeah. And it seems like that's very important, especially a game that you play for 100 some odd games a year, for how many years, yeah, and how many balls you have to hit. Like you have to, like I said, you need to hold your hat on something. You got to play with your heart a little bit. Like
all the time. If you're not, you know, I mean, it's coming a bit sterile, you know, now with the showcase baseball and everything else like this. These kids are just, they expect this. They expect the attention. They expect, you know, they expect these things to happen to them because it's been happening to them. You know, they're touted when they're 14, 15, 16 years old. They're being recruited as freshmen and sophomores when, you know, we were coming through the system. You're not recruited until you're maybe going into your senior mm-hmm. year. Sometimes after your senior year, that summer, that's when you decide if you're going to college or not. So, you know, it's the environment's changed. There's so many expectations of the player to the system, not the system of the player. You know what I mean? So they, you know, these guys feel like they're entitled to certain stuff and not always constantly look at it as like, look how fortunate I am. Look at this, man. I'm making millions and millions of dollars and I get to put on this silly uniform every day, fly around in chartered jets, stay in the best hotels, and play this game and get to compete against the best of the world every night. A lot of guys are taking it for granted. And that's annoying for old school guys, you know. I mean, and there's guys older than me that are older school guys that, you know, it's really probably chapping them. You know, you see the way that they carry themselves, you know, the hats on backwards, you know, the bling, the earrings, all this other stuff, the flash. But you can't stop it. You know, the game's changed. The athlete's changed. We're watching Cam Newton act the way that he acted. That's the athlete today. You know, it's sad. It's disappointing. But so you have to, you know, that's why I enjoy what we do at this level, because these kids are still impressionable and we can maybe, you know, have some type of effect on them when they get into that position, not to be that arrogant, cocky. You know, you have to have some humility to you. Obviously, as athletes, you know, we have egos and we have a cockiness about us.
There's winning and losing. You know what I'm saying? And you have to do both. At some point in time.
And how do you handle both of them? You know, that's right. That's the same thing. I mean, Cam Newton's, you know, he's celebrating, jumping in and handing out footballs and dancing and everything when he wins. But the minute he takes one in, you know, that was sad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, I understand some of it with that. It was just brought up with Cam. But, like, I always think the teammates, when he's in the end zone, like, shouldn't you be going to your teammates? Like, especially your offensive line, because that's what I played in high school. Like, you know, those are the people that got you there, you know. And sometimes, at the end of the day, those are the people that you have, you know. I mean, granted, you know.
And, you know, just singling out Cam Newton, I mean, it's in every sport.
It's in every sport. You know? Becomes so individualized that you forget the people that are around you.
Right.
And it's in a lot of things now. There's the a lot of sports and a lot of just – entertainment and other things, it's so singleized and I'm so front and center that you forget about all the people that have put you there and got you there. Because at the end of the day, you know, those are the people you got to hang on to.
You know, there's athletes out there that don't handle that. I love watching Steph Curry. Mm-hmm. And you watch his teammates with him. They love him.
Yeah.
You know, and he's unselfish. We want to see him play here in Charlotte. And, you know, he didn't score a point in the first quarter. He was dishing it off, getting everybody else into the game. Yeah. And then all of a sudden he took it over and he scored 40. But, you know, it wasn't about him. It was about winning, and, you know, they were on that great run at that point.
Because it's fun with other people. When it's by yourself, sometimes it's not as fun.
You know, in the end, you're going to end up that way. Mm-hmm. You know, you're going to not, you know, the people that are going to want to be around you are the people that don't need to be around you when you're that type of person. So.
Yeah. Well, as we wind this down here, there's something that I always talk about on this podcast. I always just bring this topic up there and kind of whatever pops in your mind, whatever topics or thoughts come about it is the idea of success. like, is it obtainable? Do you, how do you deal with it when you get that? Do you think, you know, what does that mean to you when you say success? Like, oh, I'm a successful person, or this was a success, or what I did was successful. Like, what pops in your head when I say that?
Success is what I was able to do for somebody else today. That's my success. And that's our success in this building. And that's our success, you know, should be that way in life. You know, again, if I'm out there just trying to make myself successful every single day, then I'm going to live in a lonely, selfish environment. And for me, success is what, you know, who can I help? Who can I do? What can I do? You know, where can I be? Can I make somebody laugh? Can I make somebody, you know, can I make somebody happy? Can I change somebody's day? You know, can I make a kid a little bit better? You know, somebody need a hug, you know, somebody need a high five. That's success to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, now would be the time to give all the information how people can come here and learn and benefit from this knowledge that you've cultivated over decades of hard work. How can they get in touch with you and get in touch with this wonderful center?
Well, I appreciate that. It's cbcbaseball.net is our training facility. All the information on our teams, which is the DeMarini Stars, North Carolina, it's our showcase environment. They're high-level players. They're committed players. That information can be kind of navigated through cbcbaseball.net as well. We do lessons, we do teams, we do camps, we do clinics, we do showcases, we do everything that's involved in promoting the youth baseball player to the next levels. We're heavily involved in USA Baseball in the National Team Identification Series. We're regional directors from Maine all the way down to Mississippi. So we see a lot of kids, a lot of talent. It's very cool. You know, it's if you don't want to take a shot at playing at your national team, there's something wrong there. You know, mm-hmm. there's all these crazy showcase environments and things like that you can go to that you think you're getting exposed, but you know what? Go see if you can represent your country and wear that flag. It's, it'd be pretty cool. So it's cbcbaseball.net. There's at any time, you know, there's six former major league players in here that don't walk around with egos patting themselves on their back. There's six major league players in here that are looking to give back what the game's given them in terms of knowledge and just fun, you know. It's just it's a big clubhouse for us, so mm-hmm. We love it.
All right. Well, Jeff, thank you very much for taking time out of your day and sitting down and talking to me. And we better get out of the way because I'm sure somebody will be hitting some balls
yeah,
or throwing some
soon.
Balls in this area. We're about
soon.
A few minutes away from
you
that,
are.
So we
yes,
better
you are.
We better bail. But thank yeah. you very much for taking.
I really appreciate you taking the time to do this for us. I look forward to seeing it.
All right.
So, thank you.
This has been a DSCT.TV production.